The Tom Woods Show, episode 633.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, gang, I got an easy way for you to earn 50 smackers. You listening? Ebates has changed its reward policy. You refer two friends and you get 50 bucks. Ebates rewards you for shopping at a wide array of online retailers with cash rebates. And you get 50 smackers if you refer just two friends. Surely you have two friends, then you can have 50 smackers in your pocket. Check it out at tomwoods.com/ebates. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, and I am so glad to have Chris Guillebeau back with us again. It's been way too long. And Chris, who is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The $100 Startup and The Happiness of Pursuit, is back today, April 5th, 2016, with a brand new book that is indeed released just today called Born for This, subtitle, How to Find the Work You Were Meant to Do. And he's got a neat little site around the book. It's bornforthisbook.com. And he's got a neat little quiz there you can take to find out what exactly is the work that you were meant to do. So it's really great, and it's got his tour of the country, all the dates of all his appearances. He's a really interesting guy, and if he's coming to your city, I recommend going out and seeing him. So bornforthisbook.com is the site of his brand new book just released today. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for having me back. It's a big honor.
I absolutely love this book. I love what you're doing. I've been focusing on this theme quite a bit on the show. Born for This. I told people about bornforthisbook.com. I love a landing page that has a quiz on it. It draws people in. It's just so smart. I mean, you're actually doing and living the very things that you're showing people how to do in the book. Now, you've written other books on entrepreneurship and trying to figure out, you know, where you fit into the whole picture. How does this differ from what you've been doing up to now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for saying that. You know, the quiz is free. People can go on the website. They don't have to give me their email or anything. You know, I wanted to actually make something that's genuinely helpful for people. And I remember the last time I was on your show, I think it was episode 150 or something, and now you're up way past 500. So it's just amazing to kind of come back full circle. As for this book, you know, it's called Born for This. The thesis of the book, you know, you mentioned briefly, is how to find the work you were meant to do. So I am an entrepreneur. I have an entrepreneurial bias, but I also realize that, you know, there's more than one way to kind of find your life purpose, and people can be fulfilled and purposeful, like in an organization or a company. But what I want to do is help people think entrepreneurially, you know, whether they actually want to go into business for themselves. So for this book, I looked at all kinds of different people, you know, who had been successful. And when I say successful, I don't just mean wealthy or they had status or something. Like sometimes they did. But when I say successful, like they were purposeful, they were meaningful, they determined what their own success was. And so I kind of wanted to extract their lessons and go back and say, okay, what did these people do? Like they're very different, you know, men and women, different ages, backgrounds, et cetera. What do they have in common? How did they find or create what they often called their dream job? So this is an exploration, a case study driven method of how people can win the career lottery and find their dream job.
I like the scripts that you have. I'm looking at early on in the book, scripts 1 through 4. These are four customary ways we've been taught to think about how people come to wind up in the job that's for them. And I'll pick one of them because I have fallen into this one. If a career opportunity, any opportunity comes your way, take it. You'll probably only get this chance once, so don't blow it. That's been my attitude because I've had a lot of opportunities come to my way, and I feel like, okay, I've had a lot of opportunities up to now, but I don't know that next month I'll have another one or next year I'll have another one, so I better grab them while I can. And that's just all wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, it's scarcity thinking, and we all kind of tend to do it at certain times, as you said. You know, there's this great quote by Richard Branson, I think. He said, opportunities are like buses. There's always another one coming. And, you know, what I saw, speaking of successful people, most of them did not follow a linear path. Most of them actually went down lots of roads. Most of them didn't know, you know, when they were 6 years old, here's what I want to do when I grow up. And then here's what I'm going to study in college or if I'm going to go to college or not. Like I'm on this very linear path. Most of them did a lot of different things. They even made mistakes, and mistakes helped them kind of help to inform their decisions. right? So it wasn't like they were following every opportunity. They missed some opportunities. They gave up on some opportunities, but eventually, you know, they got closer to that thing that they were born to do because they were willing to experiment, because they were willing to take some risks.
Explain to me the joy money flow model, and then I have a juicy follow-up for you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so in short, you know, what I saw is people like to do different things, of course. Everybody wants, you know, their own career, their own kind of work. But what these people who found or created their dream job had in common was they all had this kind of convergence or intersection of these three qualities: joy, money, flow. So joy is doing something that you love to do. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, following your passion. There's lots of passions you could follow that aren't really, you know, viable or something you should do for your career. But nevertheless, they like their work. Money is something that is sustainable. This is not a hobby. This is something that's going to, you know, feed your family and allow you to do everything you want to do. And then flow is something that uses your unique skills. It's the kind of work where you can get lost in it. You can do it for a couple of hours. You don't realize the time has gone by. Maybe it's something that other people struggle with, but for you, you know, it's this perfectly natural thing. So what I found is, you know, sometimes in life we settle and we make compromises, and it's okay to do that for a time. And you might say, I have this job. I don't really like this job, but it's a means to an end. You know, I have to have the money to take care of stuff. So that's fine. But the goal, you know, the goal that we're working toward is, you know, intersection of all three things: something I like to do, something that makes good money, and something that uses my skills. I think if you get closer to that, you're going to be a lot happier.
If you read your book, you will get some idea of how to sit down and plan this out. Think about it. You know, be strategic. Figure out what your assets are, and, you know, what your liabilities are. Maybe things that you shouldn't try to do.
Right, right.
My juicy follow up is, and Chris, please understand, even though this is an ideological show, I am not trying to draw out some kind of crazy ideological response from you. I mean, this is just a genuinely curious question that I've had about just the typical, you know, K-12 education that people get after they're done with that.
Yeah.
How much time, and this is sort of a rhetorical question, mm-hmm. in those 13 years have they spent trying to sit down and identify where can I fit myself into this nexus of exchange that is the market in a way that gives me something that's rewarding, spiritually rewarding,
right,
emotionally
right.
rewarding, financially rewarding, and that maximizes the use of my skills? When have they been told, or how have they been told to sit down and think about this?
Yeah, well, actually, I don't think it's a very, you know, controversial ideological question. I mean, the answer is really simple. They haven't had any time. You know, this is not something that's taught. You know, we don't actually teach people, you know, how to find purposeful work. We also don't teach them about soft skills. This is something that I learned a lot through the research. And you know, all my work is research-based. You know, I'm not just trying to make something up or prove a hypothesis. You know, I spend a couple of years interviewing lots of people and extracting, you know, okay, what are these common lessons, not just what are the differences. So, you know, hard skills are like these technical skills. You know, hard skills are what you learn usually in college or in your first job, your engineering skills, your programming skills, whatever it is that you do. You know, and most people focus on improving those skills. But what I saw as like a predictor of success is your soft skills. So those are all those things that you mentioned, like how do we actually, you know, come to the center of these things? How do we learn to communicate better? How do we learn to negotiate? How do we follow up on tasks? You know, we've all been in these meetings where like tasks are kind of divvied up, but then nobody does anything. And there's lots of good ideas, but you come back the next week and no progress has been made. If you can learn to be that person that follows up and has those good soft skills, you know, again, you're going to be much more successful. But you don't really learn that in school. You don't learn that in K-12. You don't actually learn it in college either. So you have to kind of learn it on your own. And when you learn it on your own, you'll be a much more valuable employee. Or if you don't want to be a valuable employee, you'll be much better off when you go out on your own.
You know, you get a lot of talk sometimes about mindset. You have to have the right mindset. I think a lot of this is just platitudes and fluff.
Right.
But on the other hand, there are certain ideas that we've been conditioned to have about what our career expectations should be all about, and that we should be, you know, working 9 to 5. And I do think there are some aspects of our mindset that can, in fact, hold us back from discovering what we really ought to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's not something that's pie in the sky. The more we know about how we do our best work, not only the more productive we're going to be, but also the more fulfilled and the happier we're going to be. So another thing I was really surprised about, which makes sense, you know, in retrospect, but nobody really talks about this, is when you think about, you know, the kind of work that you're born to do or getting closer to something that you love, everybody always thinks in terms of professions because that's what we're taught. You know, when you're a kid, what do I want to be? Oh, I want to be a firefighter. I want to be the mailman. You know, I want to be an astronaut or the president or something. Even when you go to college, it's all vocation focused. Or even if you're a bit older, you want to make a second act somehow. You're thinking, what kind of career can I go into? it's just as important, if not more important, to understand what I call your working conditions or your ideal working conditions. And the quiz that you mentioned in the beginning of the show, you know, from the website, that helps people find their ideal working conditions. So that's things like how you like to spend your time, what your ideal schedule is, where you do your best work. You know, do you do your best work from 9 to 5 in an office? I mean, some people do, but a lot of people don't. You know, how collaboratively do you like to work? Most of us like to do some kind of work on our own and some kind of work with other people, but there's a tremendous range. You know, how do you like to be motivated and incentivized or compensated? And people are rewarded in different ways. So if you can kind of understand this about yourself, again, this is how you get insight. You know, this is how you'll kind of figure out, okay, you know, here's the kind of work that I want to do, but here's the way that I want to do it. And I think figuring out both of those things is really key.
It's a twofold process, really, because you have to ask yourself what it is that you want to do, but then you also have to find out from other people what they want to have done. And you give a good example, by the way, when you're talking about some of the guides that you've prepared, and you say that when I've really listened to my audience and I produce a guide that is in conformity with what they're looking for, it does really well. But if I just produce something – you didn't put it quite this way – but if I just produce something, say, well, here's the latest thing from Chris Guillebeau, well, that doesn't necessarily cut it. And I've had the same thing. I say, well, they like the Tom Woods show, so I guess that means anything I'm interested in that goes on the show, they'll want to listen to.
So it's good, you know, it's good to have these humbling experiences, actually. You know, it's good to kind of like, oh yeah, you know, it's actually not just about who I am. Like, ultimately, it's about what am I creating? And the market decides, of course, you know. So listening is very important. And, you know, sometimes people aren't even sure like what they are good at. And so, you know, there are skills tests you can do, but I think it's just as important to listen, you know, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're in a job, if you kind of pay attention to the questions people ask you. You know, they're like showing that you're a recognized authority and something that they care about. Once again, if you're in this group meeting, you know, and things are being handed around, you know, when they look to you and they're like, oh, here's this thing, Tom should do this. It's almost like the group is recognizing here's something that you're good at. So pay attention to that, because that could lead you somewhere.
You talk about being a problem solver, and of course, that's a key thing. If you can solve people's problems with a minimum of pain, they're going to want whatever your good or service is. So that's very important. And then also, you have, just building on what we were just saying, you have this section on setting up shop by talking to 100 people. Again, listening to what people are saying, what their own problems are. And, you know, before we started talking on the recording, we mentioned John Lee Dumas, who's been a guest on this show, and he's a real master of that, because he just listens, what are the pain points of my listeners? So, for example, he has a webinar promoting his major flagship product, his Podcaster's Paradise site, but people watching that webinar asked, well, how are you doing this webinar? I'd love to know how to do webinars. So he created a webinar product.
That's perfect. And so this is a great entrepreneurial example that you're giving. And I think maybe if anybody's in the workplace, you can also apply this, right? You can also identify what are the pain points in my workplace, in my organization, my company, and how can I solve them, even if it's not really my problem. You know, even if like, here's my department, this is my little, you know, fiefdom or kingdom, and I work on this, but I see this big problem over here. You know, you increase your value tremendously, you know, by solving problems, by adding to the business's bottom line, even if that's not really your job. You could be a manager, administrator or something, but if you can help increase profitability, then all of a sudden you're much more valuable. And, you know, I use this model in the book called the self-employed employee, you know, and I really like this concept of, even if you work a job, you think of yourself as being self-employed, because nobody's ever going to care about your career as much as you do. And you just decide, okay, you know, I am leasing out my talents to this company or to this organization. And I'm going to do it for this fixed amount of time. If it continues to be a good thing, then that's fine. Maybe I'll continue. And of course, I'm going to do a good job for them, because I want to be valuable. But I'm also going to be thinking about myself. I'm going to be investing in myself. I'm going to be increasing my odds of winning the career lottery. I'm going to be improving those soft skills. Maybe I'll build a little side hustle, you know, that I do in my part time that is then going to bring in additional income, give me more opportunities and possibilities. So, you know, really it's essentially about how can we empower people, you know, in all walks of life so that they are more successful.
In your table of contents under the self-employed employee, you always have an objective under the title of each chapter. And the objective of that one is become indispensable. And one of the strategies that a friend of mine recommends is that you're in some company and you've got some particular area that you're focused on. You start a blog. It doesn't matter if many people see it, but your boss will see it, and people in the company will see it. And you are on top of everything. You're on top of the conference papers. You're on top of the news in the field. And you begin – and no one else is going to do this.
Right.
So you begin to seem seem like the guy who really is working extra and who really is on top of things. And certainly if we have to get rid of somebody, it's not going to be you.
Right, right. Absolutely. I mean, that's another way of adding value. That's another way of solving problems. When you're indispensable, when you're the hub, I mean, that's a great example of saying, like, here I am the hub, I'm creating this newsletter, this blog, or whatever, then you're kind of, then you're like a filter. You become a gatekeeper, which is kind of funny because in a lot of my work, I'm kind of anti-gatekeeper. You know, I'm helping people, like, you know, avoid gatekeepers. But if you're the gatekeeper, well, then you benefit, basically.
Right, right, right. Or even something, even a blog that just focuses on the company, developments in the company, you interview people in the company. Well, look, everybody, even the higher ups, they love to have their picture taken. They love to be quoted. You know, sure, there are all kinds of things that you can do. And I mean, what do you feel like? You know, you must hear that. I mean, I hear this a lot, that these days, boy, things, it's a tough economy and people don't seem to have the income and job security that we feel like they once did. Yep. And yet at the same time, because of the internet in particular, there are so many low-cost startup opportunities that it's hard to make sense of this idea that on the one hand, things are more insecure than ever, but on the other hand, there are more opportunities than ever.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, I'm glad you said the second part. That's what I was going to throw in. You know, we are in this kind of time of turmoil with insecurity, and job security doesn't exist in the same way that it used to. But, you know, at the same time, now it's totally normal to work from the coffee shop and to have your little side gig and be a freelancer or consultant or to start this business opportunity on the side that ends up taking off. You know, like there's a story in the book about this guy who started a side business designing T-shirts and selling them through Facebook ads. This was just something he did a few hours a week, and it became a six-figure business. So there's no guarantee that everybody listening here is going to go out and start a six-figure business next week. But I would encourage everybody to experiment and to get something started quickly without spending a lot of money, without taking a lot of risk. One, because you never know. Two, because it's going to increase your confidence and your security. Even a small amount of money coming from a different source is disproportionately satisfying, because you're going to look at it and be like, you know, I made that. I got that PayPal notification in my email, or, you know, I signed my first client. It feels very different from traditional employment, you know? So it's great. And then third, you know, when you look to the future, you know, if you love your job, that's great. You go to work because you want to go to work, not because you have to. That's wonderful.
Now, you're right that a lot of people aren't going to want to take a lot of risk, but you've got a couple of strategies for how people can make themselves feel a little bit more secure enough that their tolerance for risk will gradually begin to increase.
Yeah. So there's two parts to that. You know, one, I think it's first of all, let's look at what really is risky. Let's think about perceived risk, because I think a lot of risk is perceived, you know, more than real. And, you know, I for me as an entrepreneur, I think being an entrepreneur is actually the safe choice. You know, it's the conservative, risk-averse choice, and it is for a lot of people as well. Like, I'm investing in myself. I'm not, you know, entrusting my talents to somebody else or to a boss or to a company that might get bought or sold or, you know, whatever. So I think actually the first part is like what really is risky versus what is safe. And then, you know, for the second thing, again, like let's make small bets here, you know, and everybody's busy. You know, like I know this is the objection to starting your side business, like, oh, I don't have time, you know, like I'm working all this time, I've got my family, I've got these other commitments. Like, I get it, everybody's busy. This is the culture of the busy. It's almost like being busy is the social currency these days. But at the same time, you know, being busy can be a benefit, because you don't have time to waste. You don't have like this wide open space of like, oh, next week I can spend 50 hours, you know, working on my side project. I've got 3 hours basically that I'm going to carve out, and you know, I'm going to not watch my favorite TV show or something just this once so I can work on my thing. I've got whatever I do, I have to make that time count. So I think it can be a benefit just as much as it is, you know, something that's hard.
I think I've been at my most productive when I was back in academia and I had a crazy teaching schedule. That meant that every 20-minute period I had during the day was precious, and I made I put it to good use. So I think there's definitely something to what you're saying. And then another way to – let's say you have in mind the idea of starting a high-ticket offer, but you don't want to invest resources if no one's going to buy it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I heard this from Pat Flynn or where it was John Lee Dumas or somebody, but they have an interesting idea of try it out with crowdsourcing, like offer it at a really low – let's say offer it for $247, and if you get 100 takers, then that means there's a market for this thing. And if you don't get 100 takers, you give everybody their money back.
Yeah, no, I like that. So it's essentially a way of testing it, you know, testing it before you actually make it. I mean, there's a story I told in the $100 Startup previous book about someone, I forget the precise details, it's been a few years, but he actually didn't even make the product. He just kind of advertised the product, to see if anybody would buy it. This was kind of a high price thing. It was like maybe $500 to $1,000. It was some kind of detailed guide to some specific information. And he was like, am I going to get an order or not? So he got two orders, and then he said, okay, now I got to make it. And so he actually wrote to the people and said, you know, hey, you know, I'm working on a new and improved version. You know, it's like a 2.0. You know, if you can just wait, you know, 7 days, you know, I'm going to give you the 2.0 one at no additional cost. And if you don't like that, you know, then of course I'll give you your money back right away. You know, and I thought that was really funny. And of course, both people said, oh, I'll wait 7 days, you know, for the better version. And he spent the next week, you know, making this product. And then he of course, went out and sold a lot more of them. Because there was this proven demand. So there's lots of different ways to kind of test things and see, okay, before I, you know, invest a lot of time, invest a lot of money or other resources, is it going to be successful?
I want to zip ahead. Let's talk about some of your later stuff here in the book. I've just been reading something by T. Harv Eker, who's a multimillionaire entrepreneur, and he says, and he has it's I think it's sort of politically incorrect the way he phrases things. He'll always say, "Rich people think this way, and middle class and poor people think that."
Sure, sure.
You're not really supposed to talk like that. But one of the things he says actually is that rich people think both and. They think, I can have family and financial success, whereas the poor person thinks, well, look, the reason I'm not financially successful is there are more important things in the world than money. And he says, oh, come on. You can have time with your family and be financially successful. Well, you have a chapter in here called How to Do Everything You Want, and then the objective is refuse to choose. What are you driving at there?
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, it's the classic choice between like your money or your life, and you know, I think we do have this notion that we have to choose. And, it, you know, the rich people, middle class people, poor people, it's almost a mindset, you know, because, you know, you know somebody who's listening might say, well, I'm not a rich person, but I have the mindset, you know, of both and I'm going to get there. I am going to get whatever I want. And I am going to find a way to have, you know, joy, money and flow in my life. And so in that particular chapter, I'm looking at this model of people who have been very successful without choosing a niche. And, you know, I kind of debunk a lot of, you know, classic entrepreneurial advice. And you know, one of these things is you must choose a niche. You must be kind of hyper-focused on something because, you know, people aren't interested in your whole life. And so I was looking at people, you know, famous people like Richard Branson, mentioned him earlier, you know, Oprah, people like this who have actually been successful across lots of different industries, have influence in lots of different ways and did not choose a niche. And you can probably think of somebody you know as well. It's not just like a famous person. Like everybody listening can probably think of someone they know who's been successful, who has been that rich person or wealthy or purposeful or, you know, whatever they define success as. And they do more than one thing. Like they found a focus, they found a direction perhaps that everything comes underneath. But it's not like, you know, they're the world's leading expert in this one tiny topic. You can be yourself essentially.
Yeah, you know, in a way, I've kind of followed that because in academia, you have to be hyper specialized. You have to be the expert on the 1920s in the American South. And I just thought, I would really rather pull all my fingernails off than be the expert in that. I would hate – so I loved teaching the survey courses where, yeah, it's true you have to learn everything, but it's a lot more fun to live your life that way. And even here, I have a libertarian podcast, but, you know, next month I've got a – you know, I've got a marketing and entrepreneurship site launching that I'm excited about that is, you know, tangentially related to what I'm doing now. But I've gotten to the point where I want to do what makes me happy. I want to do what's fun for me. And now I've built up enough security in what I'm doing as my natural work that I can sort of take the plunge and take the risk doing this other thing. So I'm living the Chris Guillebeau life here.
I think you've created, you know, the Tom Woods life, which is fantastic, right? Because it's boring to do one thing. I mean, some people actually are kind of built where they're like, I just want to do this one thing and I'm going to excel in that. And that's fine. Like, I respect it. But I respect it from a distance because I'm not that person. You know, I am motivated by doing new things and different things. And hopefully I'm building towards something. And hopefully it all kind of relates, you know, tangentially, as you said. But, you know, I don't want to just do the same thing. I kind of get stagnant when I do that.
I want to also talk about I love somebody who come up with good chapter titles. Once in 5 years, I come up with a good title. So I can really appreciate a good one when I see it. I just can't think of any. But Winners Give Up All the Time is an awesome title because it's true that there are some things that you shouldn't persist in and you should stop doing them. You should quit sometimes.
Well, that's my
message. How do you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is the message I'm kind of taking out on the road, you know, all across North America over the next couple of months, because speaking of the classic entrepreneurial, you know, American manifest destiny, pioneering spirit advice, you know, there's lots of good stuff there, of course, like, you know, I'm in favor of much of it. But, you know, this notion that persistence is the most, you know, important predictor of success is simply not true, because, you know, you can be doing something that doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, you can try it, you know, as much as you want, you know, try again. You know, I think you should try again in a different way. Again, looking at successful people, they went down lots of paths. If something didn't work out, they weren't afraid to kind of walk away from it. And it doesn't even have to be a huge failure. It doesn't have to be a disaster. It can even just be something that's working out okay. You know, if something is working out okay, that's not the goal. That's not the dream, right? So as to how you know, like, when to give up, when to keep going, I mean, you ask yourself two questions. You know, first question, is it working? Second question, do I still enjoy it? You know, if it's working and you enjoy it, great, keep going. You know, if it's not working, you don't enjoy it, walk away. You know, step back, find something else. You only have to do a little bit more detailed level of analysis when the answers conflict. You know, if something isn't working out, but you still kind of fundamentally believe in it, and you think, okay, maybe I just need to tweak this. Maybe I need to change it up. Maybe I need a different strategy. So you do keep trying, but you try in a different way. And if it's the opposite, like, oh, it's working okay, but I'm ready to do something else, then you have to figure out how to make a transition. If it's a business, can you sell the business? You know, if it's a job, can you find a way to leave on good terms and move on to something, you know, that's you know, more exciting for you now?
Well, Chris, today, of course, is the release date of Born for This, so I'm so thrilled we were able to have this conversation and time it just right. I'm looking at the promo site you have for the book, which is bornforthisbook.com, which of course is kind of a funny way that it sounds, like it sounds like I was born for this particular book, and maybe you were born for this book, who knows, right? But at bornforthisbook.com, not only do you have that neat quiz that you can take that'll help you figure out how to find the work that's really right for you, but you've also got a link to this tour that you've been mentioning, yep. So people can find out exactly where they can find you, and they can order the book, which I strongly recommend. I mean, there are people who join coaching programs for thousands of dollars, frankly, that teach them pretty much what you're going to learn for the price of one book.
Well, thank you very much for that endorsement. That's kind. I'm excited about the tour. I've been doing this for all my books since the very first book came out. I did my own unconventional 50-state book tour, which was totally self-funded and reader-organized. And now I'm on book number 4. I'm going back out again. I'm going to do 30 cities. All the tickets are free. I would love for people to come out. We're going to have a fun, interactive time, and we'll teach some stuff, but it won't be boring.
I have no doubt. Nothing you do is boring. This is. I think this book is absolutely thrilling. It's got just the right proportion of case studies to media advice, and it's just great. But I do have to ask you one author-to-author question before
yes,
I let
sir.
You go. I've published a number of books with a publisher called Regnery, and their view is that the old-fashioned – and nothing about what you're doing is old-fashioned, but the traditional book tour is – you know, they say it's expensive, and if we can keep you at home but get you on high – you know, large audience radio shows from your home, we can save a lot of dough. And because, of course, my tours wouldn't have been self-funded. It would have been funded by them. We can save a lot of dough and still get you a lot of exposure.
Sure.
But you're actually going out there. I mean, you know, you're traveling, you're staying in hotels. You know, the bills pile up, and yet obviously it's working for you. What do you know that they don't?
Okay.
Or is it that your stuff is better than what Regnery's publishing?
No. I don't think that's it at all. You know, I briefly mentioned like motivations and like how do you feel rewarded and compensated in the beginning. I actually am very motivated by community building. And when I go out and do these events, like pretty much every city, we're going to have a couple of hundred people come out. And they're awesome people. They've got great stories. I love to connect them. And I've been doing this for 8 years, and I think there's a lot of value in it. I do think there's business value in it in the long term. Like from that first book tour, when I went to all 50 states, and I would go to some places and there'd be 5 people or 10 people, you know, like smaller states or whatever. And some of those people are still with me now, you know, so I feel like, you know, there's value in building long-term relationships and serving a community over time. So that's why I do it.
Well, it's fantastic. I see closest you're going to be to me in Topeka, Kansas is Omaha, Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And then you're also going to be in Denver. But my gosh, you are going all – and you're going to Canada? This is unbelievable. And you're going to London? You're going all over the world at the end of this thing.
Well, this is like – I mean, this is 30 cities. You know, it's funny because I did 50 before, as I said. In the first tour, I actually went to every province in Canada too. So that was a 63-city tour. So in some ways, 30 is a little bit of a step down. But yeah, you should come out sometime. Love to see you.
Well – I'll see if I can make one of those cities work. That would be fun. And I promise I would not I won't monopolize your time. I'll just say hello. I know there are times when after I've had an event and I'd like to have people have an opportunity to buy some books. And there's that one guy who's standing there asking me 20 questions when I'm trying to sign books. I promise you I won't be that guy, but it would be nice to shake your hand.
Okay. No, I don't think you'd be that guy. Most people are awesome. Most people aren't like that. I've probably been that guy at some point in my life too, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's why I try to be kind, because I think, yeah, I remember when I was in college, I was definitely that guy. All right. The site that you want to check out for this book is bornforthisbook.com. That is not a hard site to remember. I'm going to link to it on the show notes page in case you forget. That's tomwoods.com/633. Best of luck, Chris. I assume you're already in Portland now?
I am indeed in Portland. Tomorrow, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Dallas, Houston, everywhere else after that.
Excellent. Everybody check it out at bornforthisbook.com. You won't be bored and you won't regret doing it. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, I do hope you'll check out bornforthisbook.com. I've got that linked and my previous conversation with Chris over on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/633. And remember also to make sure and get that free course on the presidents. No president worship going on here, just the real stuff. The real story about the U.S. presidents, warts and all, over at freehistorycourse.com. All right, that's it. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.